Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. I've been getting ready for a guest this week who's going to be talking about the new artisan salts, and it got me reading. Now, we know that salt meant survival for early humans, but then it started to be traded. And many of those early roads were salt routes. Now they're major highways. Salt was power. Kings decided who got it and who didn't. Salt taxes helped build the Great Wall of China. And salt tax by the British started Gandhi's famous march to the sea, and that was the beginnings of passive resistance. Pretty incredible for a shaker of salt. Stay with us. Your calls and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, with four sections of ideas, information, advice, and destinations designed to help get more out of the weekend. The Wall Street Journal Weekend is available at newsstands every Saturday. The wine segments on The Splendid Table are supported by the farm families of Cabot Creamery. Oh, those moments when the hook is set. You're clueless that anything's happening, but some twist of circumstance brings you your future. Maybe your life's work. Now, you'd imagine that wine pros are born when they have that first sip of greatness. Oh, maybe the 1869 Chateau Important, or perhaps something from Napoleon's tomb. Well, wine importer Terry Thies got his life's message at a Rod Stewart concert. There was Rod in his tight leather pants, chug-a-lugging his matus on stage, and in a benevolent moment, as Terry recounts, he handed the bottle down to the twitching rockers in the front row. Well, Terry twitched, he chug-a-lugged, and the magic fairy of destiny redirected his life. Terry's written Reading Between the Wines. Terry Thies, welcome.
Thanks, it's good to be here.
So are you still at the matus?
Oh, those days are gone. The strange thing about that first experience was that I absolutely hated the wine. It just was kind of shriekingly bitter, but I realized it was something I had to at least pretend to like because rock stars liked it.
So then how did the interest in wine start? You actually drank some stuff you liked?
Yeah, it was German wine. And honestly, here goes my cred, but the first wine I ever drunk and wanted to drink again was Blue Nun. So we would drink these kind of commercial fruit-driven German wines on Friday night, Saturday night, whatever. And I'm a person who likes to catalog information. So I paid a certain amount of attention to the ones I liked and the ones I didn't. I remember once finding one I liked particularly, going back to the store, and it was sold out. So the note to self was, when one find wine one like, buy more pronto. So I think as soon as a person has more wine than he needs to drink that very night, he has sort of created a de facto wine cellar. And so I'd begun to accumulate a little bit of wine. And then for me, the kind of revelatory moment was the first time I had a really fine German Riesling, because it was such a different flavor from anything that I'd had up until that point. It wasn't really fruit-driven. It had this odd, strange kind of whetstone or mineral taste, and it tasted almost like spring water on a base of wine instead of water. Mm. So I was enormously curious about it. I had to try to understand how such a creature could exist.
There's something, though, you're doing in this book that it defies convention. Everyone these days who writes about wine is trying to demystify wine. And you talk about wine as a portal to the mystic. It's like you're trying to bring back the mystification.
Yeah, I think that the problem with the wine simplification industry is that it will tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I understand that people look at all these labels with their gobbledygook and this tremendous multiplicity of wine, and they're kind of desperate for somebody to help kind of organize this big unruly mess. And so we have all of these books and magazine articles and purporting to make wine simple. And to me, that's like teaching an infant to walk using crutches. So if you want to get the child to walk, then the child needs to walk on his own 2 feet. The other part of it is nobody needs to establish expertise over wine. You reach the level that suits you. And the best thing to do if you're not really interested in acquiring any great depth of knowledge is just to make friends with somebody who has. And that can be a person in a restaurant or a person in your local wine store. But the whole business of mysticism, wine, great wine, is an object of beauty. And we react to beauty, of course, in many and varied ways. It is at the very least an emotional experience. But because of the nature of wine's beauty, which tends to be rather abstract, and it's analogous to music in that respect, the response that we have has nothing to do with, for example, a painting where we might be moved by the picture and the story that's being told, or, for that matter, a work of fiction where our empathy is stirred as we follow the narrative. The response to music and the response to wine is a response to pure beauty. And, as I say, it's at very least emotional. But I think if you probe into the emotional response to music, you can't help but bring mysticism into the equation. Why do we respond to music the way we do? It's just an organized sequence of tones and rhythms. And yet it has the power to move us in an inexplicable way. So we take it for granted. Music is a very commonplace experience in many of our lives. And I think that because we take it for granted and it is commonplace, we don't contemplate the extent to which it is mystical. We tend to think of mysticism as something very remote and ethereal and inaccessible, and it has to do with lamas sitting on mountaintops and all ashrams and all these difficult and effete and inaccessible things. And yet I think mysticism is a rather ordinary part of everyday experience once we learn how to recognize it.
And wine can give you that, bring that to you.
Absolutely. And it doesn't even necessarily need to be great wine. It can be the wine perfect for its moment. For me, one of the moments of mysticism, a commonplace moment, is that moment where we feel, this is as good as it gets.
Oh, yeah.
And we may feel that moment in all kinds of ways. I remember feeling it one day when I was drinking Bartolino Rosé out of the bottle, sitting on a cliff overlooking the Pacific and watching the pelicans dive into the water, sitting there with a friend. And it was a lovely day and an unpretentious moment, and the wine was just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, again, you know, we tend to think of mysticism as something that is extremely rarefied, and yet it is, for me, an ordinary part of experience. It visits us every day. And if we're sort of alert to the possibility, then we can find that it deepens our life in a very entertaining way.
Terry, you've opened up a new dimension on how to approach wine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Terry Theis's book is Reading Between the Wines. Now, you can check out his chapter on remystifying wine. It's up on the website, splendidtable.org. And you're also going to find a recipe for smoky and spiced Dutch split pea soup, which would be great with one of those Rieslings that he talked about. So find the recipe and so much more. splendidtable.org. Those of us who have been cutting corners until our knives are dull, we've got some relief. Jane and Michael Stern track down the places where the prices make sense, and the food's going to make you very happy. Jane, Michael, what's the latest discovery, guys?
We have been eating our way through New Mexico. And one of the things that has happened since we last went to New Mexico is that the green chili cheeseburger, which we have long loved, has become almost like the state dish. In fact, at the New Mexico State Fair, which was going on while we were there, they crown a green chili cheeseburger king of the state.
Not a queen?
Yeah. I don't know. Green chili cheeseburger royalty, let's just say
that. All right,
okay. However, I have to say that the place that won, which we ate at, while quite good, does not measure up to the green chili cheeseburger at Bobcat Bite, which is, in our not-so-humble opinion, the best.
All right. Talk about Bobcat Bite, because you've been there before, right?
Yeah, it's such a cool place. I mean, it's on the old alignment of Route 66 on the outside of Santa Fe. And it first opened, I think, in the 20s or 30s. It's been a pawn shop, a gun shop, a
classic
trading post.
Roadhouse.
And now it's just a wonderful little diner with a grand total capacity of 26 people at counter and a few tables. So if you go there, it's likely you will wait for a seat, but it's well worth waiting for because they make, I mean, even without the green chili and without the cheese, the burger itself that they have there is absolutely magnificent. I mean, like an inch and a half thick with a crusty outside and just like running juice when you just poke it lightly. And then put on top of that like real good New Mexico roasted chilies. We happened to be there in the fall, so it was chili roasting season. And then cheese on top of that, it is a perfect combination.
Lynn, you've eaten chilies in New Mexico, haven't you?
Yes.
That's what
I
thought.
Oh, yes.
The point is that people who have never eaten real fresh chilies in the Southwest, I don't think quite understand the fabulousness of them, because when you really eat real freshly roasted green chilies,
as opposed to the ones that come
in
the can,
as opposed to the canned ones, which most of us rely on, it's like eating what's something really good compared to something
I don't mean to go poetic, but
I said truffle compared to a mushroom.
Yeah, it's almost vibrates with it's just
yes.
so fresh. Even though it's been roasted and it's mellowed, it's so fresh. It's a completely different chili experience.
And it's not really hot.
No. But let's go back to Bobcat Bite for a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Because
okay.
that business about the roasted green chili with the burger and the cheese, to me, that is sort of the essence of what it can be to eat in a place like Santa Fe.
It is, because the chili is the state vegetable, and they really honor it there. And just the combination of meat, cheese, and chili, it's like, you know, it's like the perfect food pyramid, even though it's hamburger shaped.
And bread. The
yes,
buns are very
exactly.
good.
Yeah.
Michael, why is it called Bobcat Bite?
Actually called Bobcat Bite because back in the early days when it started as a diner and that area was really wild, supposedly, bobcats actually used to come down from the hills and they would like toss them little hush puppies from the back porch out of the kitchen.
Oh, how sweet.
Little hamburgers? Or
well, I don't know what they served them, but they were little bites that the bobcats ate.
I thought maybe the bobcats came in and bit people.
No,
okay.
Only part of the service, Jane. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Santa Fe, Santa Fe, we lost the way.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest contribution to Essential Guides is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can check into their finds by heading to the website, splendidtable.org. Soup is on the mind. Over the weekend, we kind of cozied in, so I ended up making one of those bean vegetable soups that takes on anything that's left in the fridge. It was pure improv, but backed by a basic formula, if you will. Dried beans flavored with lots of browned vegetables, and especially cabbage. It's interesting because cabbage mellows out soups. Anyway, there was a lot of garlic in the soup and seasonings. But there's one or two tips here. Always brown vegetables before you cook dried beans, and then cook the beans with the vegetables. They just pick up more flavor. Also, salt the soup as it's cooking. And the last thing, don't add anything acidic to dried beans when they're cooking because that'll stop the process. So that means the tomatoes and the wine or the vinegar goes in at the last moment. Now I'm going to put my recipe for harvest black bean soup up on the website. You can find it there, splendidtable.org. And we're going to be back in a moment to talk greatness in a salt shaker and a fish sauce tasting. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Oregon Bounty Wander Feast, which hunts down a new flavor each week. This week, it's mushrooms, from hedgehogs to morels that grow wild in Oregon forests. Mushroom hunting and recipes at traveloregon.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices, at novonordisk-us.com. You know, salt's a big deal now. That shaker of Morton's is cowering in a corner, overpowered by status salts with pedigrees and provenances. Well, Mark Bitterman deals in these salts in his shop Meadow in Portland, Oregon. 120 different ones, to be specific. But trend wasn't his motivation. When he was a student backpacking in France, he saw that cooks traveled with their own salts. So as he tramped the world, he collected the local sodium chlorides. And he studied, and opinions evolved. The result is a book no one's done, Salted, a manifesto on the world's most essential mineral. Mark, it's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.
Mark, you've killed a culinary icon. Could you please read from the kosher salt entry in your book?
Well, I'd be glad to. Kosher salt is a processed food with all the mineral and moisture qualities intrinsic to real salt stripped away and with a crystal structure fabricated by automated processes. The flavor is antiseptic, like the bright fluorescence of a laboratory on a spaceship drifting aimlessly away from Earth. The texture crackles and bounces on your tongue like an undead pet, a battery-operated puppy with no hair, trying to comfort you with its soulless antics. When we cook with kosher salt, we sanctify the artificial. We embrace emptiness. We become unfit for our posts, a nakedness far worse than embarrassment.
You do not mince words. So how did you come to have these strong opinions about salt?
Honestly, I didn't know I had strong opinions until I was speaking more publicly about it, because to me, I feel passionately about all food. And I think that salt is something that has this amazing natural diversity, this natural authenticity to it that we connect to. And you can see it and you can taste it. And when you find the right salt on the right food, and it just explodes in your mouth and you get this incredibly new and more vital and exciting flavor. It's sort of like an affirmation of this quest for something more authentic and exciting in food.
This is one of those things you never think about.
Well, I think that that's just it. We take salt for granted. It's a four-letter word for this white, homogenous, industrialized, standardized product at the bottom of the supermarket shelves. And there's nowhere historically that we have been eating this. This is something that was invented about 150 years ago with the advent of the modern chemical industry. So iodized salt, a lot of these cheap sea salts, kosher salt, rock salts, they're all pure refined sodium chloride and have nothing to do with the natural food that salt has been for thousands of years.
What for you are examples that really speak to what makes salt exciting?
Well, I think whenever you find a salt that is made with such deliberation, with such intensity of purpose, that's very exciting. And that happens more often than you might think. Where I see it happening most often, sort of on a cultural level, is in Japan. There are a number of Japanese salts that are just truly spectacular in what they've put into the salt to make them come out the way they have. A good example would be there's a Shinkai deep sea salt from Japan that is harvested with seawater that is 3,000 feet under the ocean, and they pull the seawater up. They bring it into a greenhouse. They spray that water onto bamboo mats that are suspended from the ceiling of the greenhouse. That water slowly trickles down and evaporates as it trickles down. They repeat that process for days until you have a concentrated brine. You then take that concentrated brine, you put it in a big cauldron over a wood fire, and you stir it continuously, without cease, day and night, with a wooden paddle, until slowly the crystals form. And all this deep water minerals of magnesium and other minerals get bound up in the lattice of the crystals. And you have this super, super fine, almost frond-like flakes that form. And it's this paralyzing bright white with this beautiful, delicate balance of bittersweet taste. And that salt, sprinkled on top of something fresh and simple, is one of the most incredible experiences there is.
And at 3,000 feet, you have minerals that you wouldn't have at another level.
Yeah, what's interesting is the ocean, there's something called the halocline, which is as the ocean gets deeper, the water gets saltier. And different salts pervade. There's many, many different kinds of salts in the ocean, not just sodium chloride. And so the balance and the concentration of the salts changes as you get deeper. The Japanese have a real fascination with this. There's even salts that are made where they combine water from shallow currents and deep currents to make a salt. They're very, very sensitive to these nuances.
What does a salt like that cost?
It is not inexpensive by comparison to what we're used to paying for salt. A little jar like that might cost you $10, $15 for a few ounces. But you only use a pinch at a time. So the per serving cost is a couple pennies.
So most of the salts that you talk about that have distinctive flavors, you would be using these at the end of cooking where their flavors would really make a difference in a dish?
Yeah, that's something that we generally preach in our store is to skew the use of your salt toward the end of your food preparation. This is not to say that you shouldn't cook with salt, not at all. But there are many times when you can use less salt or no salt at all while you're cooking, and that gives you the opportunity to put a salt on at the end where the salt has a little bit more autonomy, where it can show its colors and kind of interact and play with the food a little bit more vibrantly.
Well, that leads to the next question, which is, I realize this is like asking you to pick your favorite child, but do you have a salt that you like as your, in quotes, everyday salt?
I do. We have a celgri. Celgri is a type of sea salt that is evaporated in open crystallizing pans under the sun, and the crystals form on the bottom of the pan, and they are then raked up every day, and they have this beautiful, coarse texture. They have a lot of moisture, like 13% residual moisture inside of the crystal. And so it has this very pliant, yielding crystal crunch to it. And it also has this beautiful resiliency on food. So you can use it as a finishing salt on hearty foods like steak or lamb or root vegetables. But it's also just a fantastic salt. It's inexpensive and it's readily available everywhere. And it's mineral rich and all natural and harvested by hand. But you can use it in your pasta water, in your blanching your veggie water. You can grind it up a little bit with a mortar and pestle for your baking. It's very versatile.
And it could replace kosher salt.
Absolutely. It just takes a little bit more. It takes some adjustment to get to use it.
I understand. Mark, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Mark Bitterman has written Salted, a manifesto on the world's most essential mineral. Now, if you want a salt to shine and have something that's going to last for months, make preserved lemons. Mark's recipe is on the website, splendidtable.org. Every food has its epicenter, the place where it's at its very best, where it reaches heights unequaled anywhere else. And to hunt these down is great sport. Imagine tracking wine or coffee or chocolate. But Asian fish sauce? I mean, this is the liquid that smells like a locker room after the playoffs. Well, curiously, this did not deter food writer Julie Wan from the epicenter quest. Julie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Julie, is there sort of the paragon of fish sauces? Is there one brand that stands out?
Well, there are Vietnamese enclaves around the world who prefer a certain brand, and a lot of people tend to prefer either Three Crabs or the Flying Lion fish sauce. But because so much of the production comes from small families that, you know, they don't have a brand, or they just don't have the marketing ability to be able to get their names out there. So a lot of it, you know, isn't very well known.
I remember reading something about there's an island, one particular place where, you know, a dream fish sauce is made.
Yeah, this is Phu Quoc Island, which is off the southwest coast of Vietnam. And it's very well known for making the best fish sauce in the world. And I went there earlier this year to find out why exactly that was the case. And I found it very hard to find someone who could tell me why. And eventually was able to locate someone who comes from a family of fish sauce makers. You know, they've been in the industry for a couple generations. And he's a chemist. And so he explained to me that, you know, the combination of weather and the specific type of anchovy that they use in Phu Quoc, along with the traditional methods of production, helped to make their product have a higher protein content. And so essentially it's more fish flavor in their fish sauce.
And is it now, fish sauce is packed with umami, which is that protein that sort of lifts all other flavors. So if it has more protein in it, does that mean it has a higher quantity of umami?
Yes, that's exactly it. And, you know, since talking to some of these people, I've heard people using fish sauce, you know, in their pasta, in their soups, in, you know, a variety of dishes that, you know, aren't even Vietnamese, and people have been using it to just as a flavor booster. Yeah.
Now, is this one factory, is this one company that's making this great fish sauce?
No, it's a lot of small families on the island. And this particular person that I talked with, his family, they produce fish sauce, but then it goes to another company that, you know, has their own brand. And so these families really don't get any of the recognition and very little of the profit, actually.
What's involved? Can you briefly explain how it's made?
Yes. It takes three parts fish to one part salt. And after about a week, liquid starts to seep from the fish, and then it's drained and circulated back into the vat every day for a whole year. And then that's about the amount of time it takes to reach concentration, but not long enough for it to start to get acidic.
I see. So it's really a fermentation process.
Yes, yes.
And then that's what goes into the bottle.
Right.
Now, did you have to do a fish sauce tasting?
A little bit. So at the factory that I went to, they had different gradations of fish sauces. So it's a little bit like olive oil, where you have extra virgin olive oil, which is the first press. So after that first year, you have the most concentrated fish sauce. And after that, what they do is they run salt water back through the vats, so you get a less concentrated product. And that's usually used more in cooking, whereas the first extraction is used raw for dips or dressings.
You know, I can understand the olive oil, you know, connection, but the idea of tasting fish sauce, you have done heroic work.
Well, at the factory, they actually gave me a straw. They had a bowl of fish sauce, and they gave me a straw, so I was just sucking fish sauce right through the straw.
But, all right, so now, is there anything on a label that we can find and, you know that we have the wonderful dipping sauce versus the cooking sauce? Is there anything for those of us who are buying it here in this country?
Yeah, well, I would look to see if the product was made in Phu Quoc. And just because that name is on the label doesn't mean that it necessarily is. So you have to kind of read the fine print to check to see that it's from the island. And if you look for the words Nuoc Mam Ni, so Ni is N-H-I, that indicates that it's from the first extraction.
N-H-I, and Phu Quoc is P-H-U and then Q-U-O-C.
That's
so
right.
N-H-I says it's the first extraction.
Yes.
And that's for my dipping sauce.
Yes.
Hey, thank you, Julie.
Thank you so much.
Julie Wan's story on fish sauce appeared in the Washington Post. Now, for fish sauce in action, make chicken and cellophane noodle soup. It's a recipe from Andrea Nguyen, and it's in our Cheap Eats collection right on the website, splendidtable.org.
Talk to me. Talk to me.
Well, let's you and me talk. The lines are open. You can give a call. It's 800-537-5252. Or go to Facebook or send an email, splendidtable.org. And anything goes. Well, let's see now. We have got Mark calling from Charlotte. Mark, welcome.
Hey, Lynn. I have a problem. I've had a death in my kitchen.
What happened?
My box grater died.
Oh, dear.
So here's the problem. I use a huge amount of grated cheese. You know, I'll do it in my risotto. I'll do it in all kinds of things that I need to put quantities of cheese in.
Right.
I'm tired of the manual task of scraping my knuckles against the box grater. So now this thing has died. I have an excuse to replace it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the question is, ought I replace it with a mini food processor which chops, not shreds,
right,
or something like a Presto salad shooter, which I gather shreds but does very little else.
Do you do Parmesan cheese?
I do Parmesan. I do for a fresh mozzarella, I'll still use a box grater.
Yeah.
You know, mostly for Parm and for, you know, other hard cheeses. And the question I have is, does the physical difference of essentially planing a cheese and giving a flat surface with lots of surface area.
You mean, in so many words, getting larger shreds of it versus grating it fine.
Is it going to make a difference in my recipes?
It matters in the way it melts, and it matters in the way that what kind of texture you want. Now, first
okay.
of all, I have just heard about a grater that a friend who's a really serious cook adores, and I want to get my hands on it. Microplane evidently makes a box grater.
And the microplane for zesting and stuff like that is fantastic.
Yes, exactly. So if they do a box grater, I think it should be pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I would use the food processor for grating, but don't let it run for any length of time. You don't want to warm up your cheese.
Okay.
So if you're grating a hard cheese, you'd use the flat steel blade and you would, you know, run it a second or two and then stop and run it a second or two and then stop. And then for the shredding of the cheese, which is going to give you a completely different taste in your mouth, I use the shredding blade on the food processor or I do it by hand. And that would be my solution. With a very soft cheese, then like mozzarella, then I want to use the box grater. I have better control on that. So that, I think, is going to work. I'm sorry for the death of your box grater, but it may open up a new world for you, you know?
Excellent. Thanks for the guidance.
You take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Now, we're going to get back to the phones in a moment, but now we've got the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what should not happen to your bagel in New York City unless you like spending money? Well, you start musing, and we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be back to the phones to talk to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Cabot Creamery, a 1,200-farm family dairy cooperative valuing community, quality, democracy, and local ownership. Producing naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese with recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a few minutes, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook or give us a call, 800-537-5252. But now I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what should not happen to your bagel in New York City unless you like spending money? Well, you should not let anyone touch it with a knife. New York tax law doesn't charge tax on whole bagels, but if the bagel is sliced, it is taxed. Well, wait a minute, I misspoke. A whole bagel is taxed if you eat it where you bought it. Now, the topper is, if you buy sliced bread in a bakery, there's no tax.
This is further proof that the law and logic do not travel hand in hand. Jacob Gershman, a political writer for the Wall Street Journal, reported on this little factoid, a case of taxing changing depending on the way you slice it. And I'm going to stop now. Back to the phones. The lines are open. Call us at 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook. We've got Ian calling from Portland, Oregon. Ian, hi. What do you want to talk about, sir?
Hi, Lynn. I'm actually currently in Minneapolis, Minnesota, visiting my friends and family. I'm originally from Minnesota, but I moved out west. But when I moved to Portland, I got a job as a line cook, and my job requires me to make soups from scratch. And I absolutely love making soups. So while I'm in Minnesota, I'm going to be visiting my grandparents. And my grandmother is an extremely traditional Irish Catholic woman with very traditional Irish Catholic routines, we'll say. I mean, she's got 8 children. And
holy cow.
Like, yeah, I'm one of like 50 grandchildren, so it's crazy.
Brother.
So every time there's a family get together, it's always all the men sit around and watch football and do manly things while all the women are in the kitchen cooking for like 16 hours straight. It's crazy. So when I told her that when I visit, I'm going to make her one of my favorite soups to make, which is a beer cheese soup, very American style.
Right.
Very thick and rich. And I was just wondering if you had any suggestions on like a side or something.
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is some kind of salad, because you've got, you know, the beer and the cheese is going to be really rich. And if you were to take a green salad that had some tart greens in it as a, you know, to kind of a shot of something acidic and crunchy against that velvety soup, wouldn't that be good?
Yeah. The beer cheese has like a consistency of like a fondue, you know, but I mean, sometimes I throw bacon in there. Sometimes I throw sausage.
I have got a scathingly brilliant idea.
Oh my gosh.
You're going to get some tart apples. Tart green apples like Granny Smith or Northern Spy. You know, I don't remember Northern Spies are green. But anyway, you're going to get a tart apple and a really crunchy one. And you're going to get curly endive and bib lettuce and, you know, if you want some of that spring mix kind of thing. Mm-hmm. A real mixture. And the curly endive, because that's really tart.
Yeah.
You know, and crunchy. You're going to slice that thin. The rest of it you just tear up. Okay. And then you're going to slice the apple with the skin intact. You'll just core it, slice it into really thin slices, and you're going to toss that all together with just a very basic oil and vinegar dressing and salt and pepper, good olive oil, some good cider vinegar. Okay.
Because, like apple cider vinegar?
Yeah, an apple cider vinegar because you've got the apples in there. Mm-hmm. And then I'd throw in some nuts of some sort, maybe toasted walnuts or
toasted hazelnuts or something.
Hazelnuts
like that
would be great. Oh, but anyway, the point being, a really nutty toasted nut. And I think that next to the beer and cheese soup is going to be just wonderful.
What would you say to, like, if I did some, like, poached balsamic pears or something like that?
Oh, that would be lovely. You mean for dessert?
Man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
cool.
Yeah, balsamic and white wine with sugar and a vanilla bean?
Ooh.
Could that be bad?
Maybe it's just a little overboard. It sounds amazing, but I don't want to, like, blow anybody's mind, you know?
Then I'd chunk up those pears and I'd bake them in a pie.
Wow.
You know?
That sounds delicious.
I think your grandmother's going to thoroughly enjoy this.
I'm excited.
I hate to be corny, but what a nice way to thank her.
I know, exactly.
For all those 16-hour meals.
Exactly.
Hey,
thank you so much.
You are welcome, sir, and you have fun with it.
I will.
Bye, Ian.
Bye.
What a nice guy. I grew up in a family like that. All the women were in the kitchen cooking, and all the men were out there watching whatever the game was, or taking a nap between meals. Anyway, we've got Bethany calling from Portland, Oregon. Bethany, what do you want to talk about? What's up?
Hi, Lynn. I was calling to ask you about taking care of pots and pans and kitchenware, because I just got married this summer.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I got to get rid of a bunch of the old stuff that we've had since college, you know, scratched up pans and that kind of thing. And
right.
I was able to go out and get some new things, but they gave me a lot of lectures at the store on how to take care of them. And I really want this stuff to last for a long time. So I just kind of wanted to call and ask what your advice was on taking care of all of my new pots and pans and making sure they last.
What kind of pots and pans have you got?
Well, I did get some nonstick, and I think they're mostly Calphalon.
Yeah.
And so those are kind of our, I guess, most frequently used items. We do a lot of stovetop cooking. And a couple of the things that I'm concerned about is, like, whether or not I can use the dishwasher, what kind of soap I should use if I do it by hand, and mostly, can I leave it with soapy water sitting in it for a couple of days, because that is sometimes how we do the dishes.
That is sometimes how many of us do the dishes. Okay, with nonstick, you don't want to put it in the dishwasher because I've heard that that can actually kind of change the structure of the nonstick part of it. But you can use a regular dishwashing soap. You know, you don't have to get any special soap, but you could use those scrub pads, you know, that don't scratch.
Mm-hmm.
That would work. But if you leave things soaking, you know, the way you're saying, for a day or so, usually then you can just take hot soapy water and a washcloth and you'll get rid of the grease and all the stuff that's sticking.
What about those, the long-handled brush type of scrubbers?
No,
that's what
we usually use. No,
okay.
It can scratch that surface. And the science behind the nonsticks I've heard is that once it's scratched, it begins to deteriorate.
Okay. Well, the other thing I got that I really have questions about cleaning is the cast iron pan.
Ah, yeah. Is it a skillet?
Yeah, it's a skillet.
Okay. This is a gem. You're going to have this the rest of your life, and you're going to love it. Okay. Have you seasoned the pan at this point?
I think so, yeah, with oil.
Yes, yes. Okay. The idea is that you don't want to use an abrasive on that either. So when you cook with it, what you do is you can scrub it out with one of those non-scratch pads and a bit of soap and water. And then what you do is you dry it on a low burner on the stove so that it dries completely that way. Otherwise, you'll have some rust. And what I usually do, if there's stuff sticking to the cast iron, I'll scrub that away and then I'll dry it. But what I'll do then is I'll just put a little slick of oil on it before I store it. And I put a paper towel on the inside so that anything I put on it isn't going to scratch it. And it's a good idea to do that. If you stack your pots, do that with your nonstick stuff too.
Oh, great.
Okay. And what's going to happen is gradually that cast iron is going to build up a gloss on it almost. And it's going to just be seasoned and gorgeous and glorious and wonderful.
Great.
Other than that, I have nothing to say about cast iron pots.
Well, I really appreciate your time. I still have one gift certificate. If you had to tell me one thing that I really needed in the kitchen, what would that be?
One thing I can't live without, and unfortunately, it's usually not inexpensive, but it is a 12 to 13 inch diameter straight-sided sauté pan. So, you know, it's a low pan.
Mm-hmm.
I cook everything in it. I do stews in it. I do sauces. I, you know, pan brown fish, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And what you want is a stainless steel interior, and then you want thick aluminum coming all the way up the sides and covering the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to run $100 maybe.
Okay.
But if you've got the gift certificate, I think you'll love that pan. And it can go in the oven because it has a metal handle. It
mm-hmm.
can go in the oven and be your roasting pan.
Okay. And stuff doesn't get stuck to it, because that's why I ended up getting the nonstick.
No, the thing about it is you want things to stick because that – I'm not saying stick to the point where you have to tear them out. But that crustiness you get at the bottom of the pan – that's the basis of flavor for things like pan sauces and stews and soups and that sort of thing. So, yeah, you get a little bit of sticking, but you use a bit of oil and you'll be home free.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, I'll do that.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. John is on the line. John's calling from Phoenix. John, hello.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'd like to talk to you about fruit storage. I live in an older part of Phoenix, and we have flood irrigation. And because of that, we have just an enormous number of desert-based fruit trees and a nice organic garden and things like that. And this year, we've been very, very hot in Phoenix. And I have an embarrassment of Mexican limes, and they are just falling off a tree about faster than I can use them. And I'm usually pretty generous with the stuff out of my garden, but I use every last one of those limes. I'm not about to give them up.
Yeah, I can understand that. I don't think I'd give them up either.
I'd like to be able to preserve them in their fresh state as long as possible.
Okay, let me think. First of all, you need refrigeration. Secondly, you want them spread out. You don't want them sitting together because that, you know, if they're touching each other, you can get mold. Okay.
Yeah, they don't like that.
All right. I don't think they need a lot of humidity. Better to have them dry a little bit than, you know, go the opposite direction. And I think you got a couple of weeks that way. Now, yeah, I know that's not as long as perhaps you want to keep them.
No.
but let me ask you this. How do you want to use them?
Well, I use them for just about everything. I mean, you know, when they're in season, I'm putting them in soups and stews. I'm making cocktails out of them. I make a lot of tarts, pies.
They have a thin skin, right?
Very thin. In fact, what you do is you wait for them to turn yellow and drop off the ground, and that way they're perfectly ripe.
Oh, brother. Because this is what I would do. Why not peel off the colored part of the peel, put that into plastic bags, right? Mm-hmm. And you put them in the freezer. Break off what you want as you need it for grated rind, okay?
Uh-huh.
And then just take the pulp and put the pulp in plastic bag. And then you can puree that pulp into things. You can press that pulp out and get juice.
That's a marvelous idea. So would you just zest the
I would zest the limes. Now, if you also have dishes you like to do where you just cook a big piece of zest in with the dish, you know, you could just take a vegetable peeler and peel off some strips and have another bag of the zest on that way. And then I would just peel all the any white pith that's left that's around the flesh. I'd get rid of that because you probably won't have much, but it's very bitter. And then you'd have the pulp. And I'd stuff the pulp sort of flat so I can break off chunks of it as I need it.
Why not just juice it?
Sure. I'm just thinking I use pulp a lot. But juice it and then freeze the juice. Absolutely. Sure. And it sounds like you have enough that you can actually do whatever you want with part of it and do the other part the other way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have buckets of them right now.
Yeah. I don't want to hear any more about the limes growing in your backyard. Hey, you enjoy the limes.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Reach us at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Eaten hospital food lately? Well, if you have, I need say no more, but I will. The disconnect borders on bizarre. You're in a place where the latest technology in healing is at work, but you're eating meals that make airline food look healthy. Well, there's a crusader on the stage. He's a medicine man, a doctor, Dr. Preston Maring, and he's former chief physician at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland, California, and he's just created its new pediatric neurosurgery unit. But food is his other beat. Well, we have Dr. Maring on the phone. Welcome, sir.
Good morning.
So how about hospital food? I mean, you go into a hospital and it's stunning. I mean, it's the lowest end of mass-produced factory food.
Well, that certainly has been the case for decades in many institutions, but I know that times are changing.
How are things changing?
Well, in response to requests by staff at the hospitals and by patients, I mean, there are hospitals all over the country now that are looking very carefully at how they source their food, and they're bringing more and more food grown locally and grown in a healthy way into their medical centers.
Are you doing this at Kaiser Permanente?
Yes, indeed we are. We serve in Northern California alone about 7,000 inpatient meals a day, and since 2006 we've been bringing increasing amounts of foods produced by small local growers that are produced organically into our institution. And this is going on at many other medical centers in the area and also around the country.
I would imagine that cost is a big factor here.
Yes, cost is a factor, but you know, some creative ways of working with it are showing up, even just having some days with more vegetarian options for patients, can reduce the very expensive costs for meats.
Oh, yeah.
And then those savings can be put back toward healthier food for the whole menu. But even more fundamental is just we're trying to figure out ways to encourage people how to use a chef's knife, because ultimately a sharp chef's knife, two cutting boards, and a salad spinner are your best public health tools. You know, the details of nutrition, to me, are not as important as just cooking food yourself, preparing it at home, and using fresh foods rather than packaged and processed foods.
You actually started a farmer's market at Kaiser Permanente.
Correct. 2003, we started an all-organic market outside of my medical center in Oakland, which was, at the time, I believe, the first farmer's market at a hospital in the country. We now have over 35 of them, and we also have seen markets starting up in many other healthcare systems around the country. So it makes it hard for people to walk past a fresh peach in the middle of July.
I can imagine that. Well, congratulations, and thanks for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Dr. Preston Maring practices at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland, California. He's known as Dr. Broccoli in the Bay Area. Well, for more information on his work, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252, or check us out on Facebook. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Mark Twain, who said, "The only way to keep your health is to eat what you don't want, drink what you don't like, and do what you'd rather not." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Our program is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. We need to say goodbye this week to our beloved webmaster, Brett Baldwin, who is moving on to newer things. It's been our pleasure to have had the opportunity to work with you, Mr. Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.